Here we go. So Friday, McCowan, Shannon with you on the program.
And you're going to get your way.
I'm going to get my what?
Way. You're going to get your way.
What
and
way?
No hockey discussion today.
Oh, we might talk hockey.
I know, but we've talked a lot of hockey.
JP Morosi is joining us, who is best known as a baseball guy, but he loves hockey.
Yeah, you know, he's got every once in a while, particularly when it comes to the college players, he's always got scoops on Twitter, so he's fun to follow.
Yeah, so we may chat some hockey, and if not, maybe later on. So without further ado, we could sit here and babble incessantly.
Which something different.
Want to do in any event. But let's bring Morosi in. Take a quick break and then JP Morosi after these. He's the guru of all things Michigan and a lot of baseball, and he loves hockey. And in spite of all those things, we like having him on. JP Morosi is with us.
Well, good morning. And Bob, I do see the Ohio State Buckeyes looming behind you, my friend. I will table the Big Ten football conversation for a later date. But what a wonderful time of year in both of our countries right now, and hockey not too far away. And I'm speaking with you on a day when the Blue Jays and Tigers begin a 3-game series at Comerica Park, and I will be there.
Oh, my gosh.
To get some fresh insights for our next conversation as well.
Well, I can give you lots of insight. Neither one of them is going anywhere is what I think. And by the way, the Ohio State, it's over the shoulder, the Ohio State logo on the wall, I am moving. As you may see, everything is gone from my office, except that one I've kept on the wall deliberately to annoy you.
I appreciate the thought, Bob, as always.
just a general rule, we talk about the Toronto Blue Jays, and maybe we'll get to them, but I there's nothing good to talk about.
Robbie Ray the other night, 14 strikeouts.
Marcus Semien.
That was
of course good. There are good things in terms of individuals. There's nothing good in terms of the team. No. Well, let's come back to that. I watched the Dodgers and Padres last night. Mm-hmm. And the Padres are such a disappointment. Would you say they're the most disappointing team so far?
Yes, Bob, they are. They are. Of course, they just recently let go of their pitching coach, Larry Rothschild, with barely more than 30 games left in the season. They lost that marathon game earlier in the week that ended around 3:30 in the morning Eastern time. They really have underwhelmed. And it's been not just one reason. It's been for a variety of reasons. They've had some injuries. They've had some underperformance. Blake Snell comes to mind based on his track record in Tampa Bay. The injuries to Fernando Tatis Jr., as we've talked about before, he had to move to the outfield. We'll see what happens in the offseason with him from the standpoint of a possible shoulder surgery. But when this season began, if you would have told me the Padres are today out of the playoffs and looking up at the Cincinnati Reds for the second wild card spot, that would have been a stunning result. And so as we speak today, I must say it is a stunning result. All the credit to the Reds, but similarly, the Padres have underwhelmed in a pretty profound way.
How much of the issue, John, is those teams in the National League on the Pacific Coast? I mean, the Giants always seem to have a little bit of life. Obviously, the Dodgers are going to win lots anyway, but how much of the pressure in San Diego is the fact that the Dodgers and Giants always seem to perform?
Well, that's a great point, John. And certainly it's a tough division in a lot of different ways. And the Giants have been a revelation in so many different ways this season. That's a club that has exceeded expectations that just about everybody outside the organization had on them when the season began. They add Chris Bryant. It's been a collective effort. They're not a team that when people ask, how are they doing it? It's not just one player. It's a lot of players who have collectively brought together a very impressive lineup. And it's not been an MVP type season for anybody, really. The Dodgers, interestingly, they have probably 3 or 4 MVP candidates, or at least in a normal year they would. And the Giants have no one, really. But Buster Posey has had a really good return to form, as has Brandon Belt, as has Brandon Crawford. Mike Yastrzemski has been very good. And then, of course, they've added Chris Bryant. So it's been a collective group that's played really well. Their pitching has been excellent. Their bullpen is almost a no-name bullpen, but that's been good too. And Gabe Kapler's done a very, very good job as the manager. And you have to credit Farhan Zaidi for bringing in a lot of the pitchers there on short-term deals. Kevin Gausman, Anthony DeSclafani, Alex Wood, Johnny Cueto, of course, nearing the end of his deal. So they've made a lot of really good decisions in the near term. And this is where, guys, and this is the flip side of things, the Giants will make the playoffs with all their one-year guys doing well. Mm-hmm. The Jays are likely to miss the playoffs. And as much as we talk about Vlad Jr., and we should, they've got three players having great seasons right now. And unfortunately for Toronto, two of them are free agents, Robbie Ray and Marcus Semien. And right now the Jays, unfortunately for them, they've got a great run differential, but it looks like they're going to miss the playoffs and waste, from that standpoint, two extraordinary seasons by players who are about to enter free agency in Marcus Semien and Robbie Ray.
So what do you do if you're the general manager of the Toronto Blue Jays? We had him on earlier this week, and he didn't seem too panicked about it. They do have a number of players that are going to get big raises, either because of arbitration or just because. And if you want to add the free agents, if you go and re-sign them, can you re-sign both? I mean, I think Ray is going to be close to a $20 million guy, maybe more. Semien's already at 18 and has done nothing to prove that he's not worth a raise. And there will be a market for Semien. Well, there'll be a market for both of them. What would you do?
I think they can only find a way to sign one of the two based on the budget. Let's not forget, they just signed Springer. And when you think about that deal for George, that's almost like two off seasons worth of your marquee signing. You can't sign everyone. And I would expect, if I'm the Blue Jays, I look at this and say, where do I have depth? I have a lot of infield depth. I have depth players like Espinal, you hope Biggio, obviously going forward. And so look at your farm system. You do have some infield depth there. Otto Lopez, of course, has arrived too, but you don't have that same depth in starting pitching, at least not until Nate Pearson proves he can stay healthy. So if I had a dollar to spend, I would spend that dollar just based on positional need. I would spend that dollar on Robbie Ray. I think it would break my heart if I'm the Jays to watch Semien leave. I think he's a first-class person. Great, great guy. He really is a tremendous leader in the clubhouse, tremendous worker, first-class citizen, everything. But if you're looking at how you have to allocate your money, you have to allocate it towards pitching, because how good would this rotation be minus Robbie Ray and Steven Matz? They have to find some ways to maintain some consistency with that rotation. And I just think they can't afford to let Robbie Ray leave. And as much as it's going to hurt them, you can't sign everybody. And I think they probably have to prioritize the pitching over the position player.
Well, I don't disagree. One of the things we talked about is where the budget of the Blue Jays is. And it appears to me that they're going to be pushing $200 million, mm-hmm. Maybe as soon as this offseason. And one of the other things that we talked about was expectations this year. Fans had high expectations of this team, and I think probably to a great extent because they actually made the play-in game or the postseason last year with an extended number of teams getting in. And so I think there was a real expectation that this team, young, improving, would be better, even better this year, and would be a playoff team. Maybe not a World Series team, but a playoff team. And now, as you said, it appears as if they're going to fall short of that. How much of a disappointment is that, or should that be? Management seems to feel like it's a building process, and while you want to make the playoffs, this isn't a big deal. Do you think it is?
I do. I do think it is, because of what we talked about a moment ago with Semien and Ray, and also the overall makeup of this club. When you sign Springer to that deal, you're signaling that you're ready to win right now. You've got Teoscar Hernandez, who, when he's been healthy, has been one of the best power hitters in the game. He's a really good player. And your catching situation has evolved a little bit. You've got Bo Bichette as a young everyday player. To me, guys, this is a team that's poised to win now, that was poised to win now. They had to make some different moves with the bullpen to sustain their run. And it looks like they're going to be just a little bit short. And that's going to sting, because you're not going to be able to keep this group together from a standpoint of the finances. And I also think one thing that that was unique about this year is the Jays decided to go for it at the deadline before the Yankees really caught fire. The Yankees have been the best team in baseball in the last month.
Yes,
and, and in late July, they had a number of issues going on. One of them was COVID with respect to their roster. And they weren't playing that well. And the Jays, we've talked about this before, the Jays' success almost always coincides with the time when either Boston or the Yankees is in a downturn. You go back in the last couple decades, you even go back to the early 90s, the Jays have almost never made the playoffs at the same time as the Red Sox and Yankees are both good. It almost never happens. It's just, it's almost mathematically impossible because they're in the same division. So I think the Jays correctly in late July said, wow, the Yankees are a little bit in a vulnerable spot. Let's go for this and try to make the playoffs now. I think that was the correct decision then. The Jays have made the correct decisions, I think, at multiple different times, but the results haven't been there. Same thing with signing Kirby Yates. That was the right deal. Just didn't work out from a health standpoint. And now you have to answer the questions about how you can have a team with this strong of a run differential, but not the right results. And I think it's going to really provoke a lot of very serious question asking during the course of the offseason of how they get better and if they've already missed part of their window, because now Boston has gotten better, the Yankees have gotten stronger, and a very difficult offseason of questions for a really good team. It's a really good team, but they're just in the wrong division at the wrong time.
You know, JP, the one thing that doesn't get talked very much about, and I think there's an assumption in the market that, you know, the young core is the young core and they're going to stick with the young core. So the question is how long will they stick with the young core? Guerrero, no doubt. Bichette, no doubt. And that to me puts the focus on Kevin Biggio. And what do you do? I mean, it may be heresy to suggest you might be able to get something really good for one of their young guys in order to try to keep a Simeon, in order to try to keep, and try to bolster either your bullpen or your starting pitching. Do you think that's ever been contemplated?
Sure. And I also think, John, that Kevin's value is probably down a little bit because he hasn't been healthy this year. He's been right in and out of the lineup. And when you consider that, and for a young player to already have an issue that keeps cropping up with respect to his back, that's concerning. That's a concerning thing. What has to be addressed so that way he's available to play every day and offensive enough to be able to hold down that position and also durable enough. And if he's not going to be durable and not going to hit for a ton of power and a ton of productivity, then he is probably a super utility player.
Well, but you said something there, play every day, play where?
Well, if Semien doesn't come back, there's a spot. Okay.
Yeah.
But there's also some young players coming up who, whether it's Lopez, Groshans, obviously, and then Espinal, who's played very well for them. I mean, Espinal has been a very, very good infielder. So we're to the point here where, John, I think the premise of your question is a fair one. Is there a spot every day for Biggio in the infield? That's a really legitimate question. But when you look outwardly, look at the numbers he's put up this year and how often he's been unavailable, and ask yourself where his value is in the marketplace. And I don't know how much you would get for him right now.
Right.
I think he'd be, in some ways, guys, I'll be honest, I think Kevin might be a better fit for a National League team. Now, obviously, we'll see how much longer the DH rule is as it is right now. But I don't think that Kevin has played consistently well enough this year that he's going to have a ton of value in the marketplace. He's still got a chance to have a great career, but his value's down now relative to where it would have been a year ago.
Look, 2 years ago, the Blue Jays outfield was the big question mark. They didn't have depth and they didn't have individual talent. And that has all changed. Of course, with the acquisition of Springer and Hernandez development. Mm-hmm. And Gurriel's been a pretty good player overall for them. I think he is the most tradable commodity that they have right now that would bring value, but also they have pieces that they could move around where they wouldn't feel his loss too dramatically. Do you agree?
It's an excellent point, Bob. And I think one thing too, sometimes we forget in the middle of the season, the underlying nature of the roster and where they have a surplus. And the reality was when they signed Springer, which happened kind of late, one of the first things that came to mind was, all right, are they going to trade Grichuk now? Or who's going to get traded? That question is still there. That question has not been resolved. The baseball has not changed in the last few months where you can play four outfielders instead of three.
What?
It's still a thing.
We got seven inning doubleheaders. We got guys starting in second and next innings. What happened to four outfielders?
You're right, John. I mean, we're bending the realities of the game here. But from what I can tell, based on my knowledge of baseball, obviously the DH is part of this, but you can't start Grichuk and Gurriel and Teoscar and Springer all in the same outfield. And so I think when you look at the offseason, it's a great point that Bob makes. And to John's earlier points too, on the payroll, you're going to have to find a way to fit. And maybe you do find a way to keep Semien, but you're going to have to move some money out, move a player out. And do you trade Grichuk to clear up some of the money to pursue Semien? Perhaps. But you also have to realize at some point, are you going to sign Vladdy? You're going to sign Bichette to the mega deal. These are contracts that are going to be very, very expensive. It does not take long in baseball nowadays to go from a young up and coming team to a very expensive team. The Padres are one example. The Padres have become expensive and disappointing at right around the same time. Mm-hmm. And that is a very, very bad combination.
Well, it is. And we haven't even talked about the bullpen, which has been the Achilles heel of this ball club all year long. I mean, that is the reason why this team is where it is, and instead of at least right in the middle of a playoff race, has been the bullpen, period, end of story. Yes, the offense over the last week or 10 days has not been as good. Lots of hits, no timely hits. But generally, the offense is fine. The starting pitching has been way beyond expectation. It's pretty solid now. Now, they don't have a lot of depth, but they have six guys who can be starters and be effective. The bullpen has been, they've been bringing kerosene in, right, instead of water to put out fires. So, and I've said for many years, I don't know whether you agree, but bullpens are the easiest thing to fix.
That's the Giants.
They can be. And well, but that's where, to John's point, you have to find the right mix. You have to find the right, and you have to hit on the right shorter-term guys. You know, sometimes when you don't have that solid ninth-inning, durable, healthy closer who's consistently there all the time, like the Phillies are going through, it still creates this multi-year issue where you're never really able to address it. And the Phillies right now are out of the playoffs and will probably continue to be there. And the epitaph for them once again will be, the bullpen let them down, and that's where they're at once again.
Would you sign a reliever to a multi-year contract though?
It depends who, of course. It depends who, but obviously, Bob, and sometimes we say that's the answer, but then you look at the Colorado Rockies. That one offseason they went out there and they signed McGee, Shaw, and Davis, and none of them really panned out there. None of them. And it's a really fickle thing to do to sign relievers to multi-year deals.
Well, that's my point. Yeah. You know who the prime example for me is? Papelbon.
Sure. You could go back, BJ Ryan's contract with Toronto years ago. You could mention him. There's a lot of, now you, some contracts more or less do work out. Andrew Miller's contract, for example, that worked out. He signed that deal and he became, of course, very good with the Yankees. Then he was traded to Cleveland and was a huge force for them. It depends on the pitcher, how old they are, what they're coming off of. But it's a very, very dangerous thing to do. And in many cases, you look at the pitchers who sign often those one-year deals, one after the other. Daniel Hudson comes to mind, who, of course, has been a Blue Jay. And sometimes pitchers who have a career like Hudson are very valuable to you because they're not going to cost you that much money. And it's often a better approach to take, but you have to have internally some pitchers to help soak up some leverage innings. And that way you can make some targeted signings as opposed to having to feel like you have to remake your entire bullpen via free agency. That is rarely the way to go.
One of the things we talked about the other day was the absence of the long reliever in the game. And I find that interesting given the way the game is played today in terms of pitching. With starting pitchers, there's a reluctance to let them face a lineup three times. There's, pitch counts tend to be higher. Guys aren't throwing as many strikes. So they get yanked earlier. There still is a spot, and maybe even more, in my opinion, a spot for the long reliever in this game. And yet very few teams have that guy. Everybody used to have one. Now very few teams have them.
Well, they have them in some ways, Bob, but it's different. It's not the same idea that you would have seen maybe in the 80s or 90s or even the early 2000s in terms of how that pitcher is utilized. What you do see is teams like the Rays or Milwaukee, where they'll have multiple pitchers they sort of stack on top of each other. And it's not necessarily a given role every day, but you have a bulk reliever, a once through the lineup reliever that you trust. And those kind of pitchers become very, very valuable to you. And that's where Tampa Bay, you think about their rotation. They have in the last year traded away Blake Snell. Glasnow's been injured. Morton is gone now. And yet they're still able to be very competitive because they have a creative way of getting through 27 outs. And their game one starter in the playoffs might well be McClanahan, someone who wasn't really talked about that much until the last year or so. He may be their game one starter. And so it's not at all the Yankee rotations from days gone by, or even the Phillies from the early 2010s, where you knew a lot about every starting pitcher that you saw. You'd seen them play for years and years and years. It's just not that way for a team like Tampa Bay. And then Milwaukee, they really rely heavily on a few starters and then creatively manage the middle innings as a result. So I actually think you're right, Bob, that the game has evolved a little bit in that respect. But the teams that do have that sort of supplemental pitching to layer in are often the best teams. Milwaukee, Tampa Bay, the Dodgers, who had David Price as a reliever for a while. Yeah. Those kinds of teams are the most formidable in the month of October.
You know, it's funny when you mentioned Andrew Miller earlier. I thought that year that he was in the Cleveland bullpen and did what he did to get them to the World Series, I figured every team would be doing that. Mm-hmm. I figure every team would be having that guy that came in the fifth and took you as long as he could. And it hasn't manifested itself that way, but, you know, maybe Andrew Miller's a bit of a freak that way.
He certainly, I mean, the way that he was utilized then, it was very avant-garde. They were almost ahead of their time to utilize him in that way, the Cleveland Indians were. So you're right. And that's where I do think it was interesting to see the Chicago White Sox, for example, when they added Craig Kimbrell at the deadline. The idea and the statement from Liam Hendricks, I think, was very appropriate and very well said and stated, that he signed there to get big outs. He's not worried about being the closer per se. He wants to help his team win. And that is, as we know, a much easier statement to make once you've already gotten paid closer money. Like Hendricks has gotten paid closer money, and Andrew Miller got paid closer money, where then they had Cody Allen, Brian Shaw often pitching after him. But Miller got the big outs of the game. He had already been paid. And I think that when you've got the White Sox right now, for example, you've got two closers who have already been paid huge sums, Hendricks and Kimbrell. And then the middle part of their pen, they've got Aaron Bummer, Kopech, Crochet, Renato Lopez can be. And he's a guy, by the way, to watch who, to Bob's point, can fill that middle inning role. Reynaldo Lopez is someone who can have that really good firm fastball coming out of the bullpen when over a short burst, his stuff is going to play up. And so often as we look at it, guys, at this time of year, your long reliever might be someone who is currently a starter, but you can shift them into a relief role once your rotation goes down to four starters as opposed to five.
Let's take a break. And when we come back, who is the best team in the American League and in the National League? Those are among the things we'll talk about. JP Morosi is with us back after these messages. Bob McCowan, John Shannon, JP Morosi, as we talk baseball to end this week. A reminder very quickly that John and I are actually going to take our first week off next week. And so we'll still be posting a new program, but it won't be a new program. It'll be a best of. So hopefully something you are interested in hearing a second time, or maybe missed the first time around. And then we'll be back the following Monday. Not so many weeks ago, I don't know what the statistics actually were, but Houston, remember Houston went on that run. The Yankees were playing like crap. I'm going to guess Houston probably had a 10-game lead over the Yankees at that point. Not that it's relevant in any way, shape, or form. As of this moment in time, they both have identical records. Mm. But it is only not even the 1st of September yet. How much, for teams like that, how much is the record in September important? I mean, it's important to get you where you want to go. We're pretty confident Houston is going to be a playoff team. There's almost no chance they won't be. But do you want to play well in the month of September, or do you want to ease into the postseason?
It's one of the eternal questions, Bob. And I remember there was one year, I think it was 99, the Yankees struggled down the stretch and went on to win the World Series anyway. They had a really tough September, but were the most dominant team overall in the regular season and then ended up winning the World Series anyhow. So it depends, I think, on the nature of the club. Is it a veteran team like those late 90s Yankees that knows October baseball, that knows how to handle it? Is it a younger club that really needs to have that wave of confidence to take them into the postseason? I think it depends on your personnel a little bit. But I've seen some teams struggle late and then turn it on. I've seen teams that play great in September. I think back to the Cleveland Indians in 2017 when they set the record with the team record with consecutive wins and then just didn't have it in the playoffs. That can happen too. So I think that it matters much more how your pitching lines up, how healthy you are, and if you're ready to go for October 1. I do think you consider where the playoff picture is right now in the American League. And the AL East is so tight that those teams are going to have to keep playing competitive games the balance of the season. Same thing is basically true out West with how well Oakland has played, or at least staying in the race. The White Sox are the one team that really, they've been on cruise control for months. And I think they're a club that can probably make a lot of decisions based on how do we line up for October, how do we look in that respect. And I think they've got a manager, Tony La Russa, who's been to the playoffs quite often in his already Hall of Fame career. So I think the White Sox are the team that maybe is at the greatest risk of being stale, but the way that Tony manages the club, I don't see that being a real risk for them right now.
Well, Chicago, of course, the White Sox were here in Toronto this week, so we got lots of chances to see La Russa standing in the dugout with his mopey face. He is the most miserable-looking manager during a game that I've ever seen. And well, more so now probably than when he was with Oakland or St. Louis.
I'll tell you this, Bob. He and you guys can appreciate this story. He and forgive me if I've told it to you before, but when I would see him in spring training, even when he was an advisor with the Red Sox, this is a couple of years ago, it's probably spring training of 20 or spring training of 19. I said, "Hey, Tony, how's everything going?" It would have been like 10 or 11 in the morning. And he'll say, "Hey, I'll tell you in 5 hours. I'll tell you in 6 hours after the game was over." In other words, his mood on March the 3rd depended on the outcome of a game that he wasn't even managing. He cared that much about every single game, every single day in the major leagues. And I think so that pain that you see, Bob, I don't want to speak for Tony necessarily, but I do think it's part of the way he approaches every single game and how much he cares. It's agony, and it's the best kind of agony. And there's only a certain number of managers who have done it, obviously as long as Tony has done it, but all these games matter so much to him. And I do think there's a certain passion and pride that goes into it. And I think to answer the question that you posed entering this segment, who's the best team in the AL? I still think in the playoffs, it is the White Sox until someone proves me otherwise. I really think that the White Sox are the best team right now. I love their depth and adaptability with their bullpen, with the way that Tony can really use all the weapons at his disposal right there. So I'm going to say the White Sox right now, but it's going to be a great race to the finish. Tampa's got a really good club. Houston, their lineup is relentless. They're just now getting Bregman back. He's a tremendous player for them. And the Yankees, of course, they've played great since the deadline, even though Rizzo and Gallo haven't even played that great. So
no,
it's
going
to be a great race to the finish. And I think as I summarize this year, we're seeing now just how good the AL is right now. These teams are just a little bit better than Toronto. They're just a little bit better than the Jays. The Jays gave away games against the Nationals, against the Tigers. You've got to win those series. If you're going to catch these teams that are so good, lose games and lose series to teams that are out of it. And then they've been doing that lately. You can't do that.
Mm. And the National League?
National League best team right now, I still think, is the Dodgers. Until someone proves me otherwise. Although, I thought it was a very interesting point. Joey Votto said this week on MLB Network that the Brewers right now have the best pitching staff he has ever faced in his career, which is really saying something. Going back 15 years or so of his career, the best staff he has ever seen. Wow. Milwaukee's got a great staff. And so I think the Dodgers, most talented team, but the Brewers are a club that no one wants to face in the month of October.
Hey, speaking of Otto, how many MVP votes?
I think he'll get some. And the NL MVP is wide open. I'll tell you this. If the Reds make it to the playoffs, and I think they will, Joey's going to be a top five finisher in the NL MVP vote.
Does anybody compete with Otani for the AL MVP?
No. I don't think so. Wow. He's doing something that we've never seen before. And there were comparisons made to him with Ruth. Ruth wasn't doing this. And I just saw Otani play in person in Williamsport, PA over the weekend, the Little League Classic. He is an incredible athlete. My goodness. His base running, he is built like an NBA forward in terms of his athleticism and the way he moves around the diamond. He is so much fun to watch. What an athlete he is, obviously, all around the MVP of the American League, and I think it will probably be unanimous this year.
Well,
with all due respect to Vladdy.
Let me ask you guys this. If Otani didn't pitch as well as hit, if he only hit, is he still the MVP? And is it fair to include his pitching? We know he's the best player in baseball overall.
Right.
But pitching should have nothing to do really with MVP. There's a Cy Young award. I mean, I know a pitcher can win the MVP award, but if he's just a hitter, is he the MVP?
I still think he is.
He
leads the AL in home runs as well.
I know.
And look at what he's been doing. So, and for me, Bob, first of all, I've been someone who has voted in the past pitchers for MVPs or had them high up on my ballot. I think last year I had Bieber somewhere in my top four. So I'm a believer that a pitcher can be an MVP and that, so therefore their pitching numbers certainly qualify as part of this discussion. But I would say even if it were not for pitching, Otani has been so good this year offensively. And certainly his team is going to be not in the playoffs, but they're sort of on the outside of the wild card mix. But really, to be honest, how different is Toronto's situation right now than what the Angels have? I think that Vlad has not put the Jays into the playoffs. If he did, it'd be a little different calculation. I think Otani, even apart from pitching, is the MVP.
Frustrating when you look at them losing games like 13-1 to Baltimore and three games under 500. I mean, when we started this conversation a while ago, you said San Diego was your most disappointing. I think there's got to be some votes for the Angels. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Disappointing team, and once again, the story with Trout remains the same.
Yeah, exactly.
He is the best player by reputation and by performance over the last decade, but one playoff appearance. I will say this, in Williamsport, Trout, not on the active roster, but he was there as a great ambassador for the game. I thought the way he interacted with the kids, he did every interview ESPN asked, and then certainly the press conference as well with us. I think Mike Trout aces in terms of the way he represents the game.
Last one from me. The Toronto Blue Jays still have 10 games left, believe it or not, against the Baltimore Orioles, which could be consequential, but probably not at this point. The Orioles just lost 19 in a row. They've won 40 games on the year. They're going to lose 100. They may lose 120 for all I know. Well, I guess they won't get to 120. But this is not just a bad team. This is a team that has been bad for some considerable period of time. How do you fix that?
That's an excellent question. And they have some internal options. Adley Rutschman's going to come up, and he's someone that is highly regarded there with the Baltimore Orioles. the question they're going to have to face this offseason is, what do you do with Trey Mancini? He is the face of the franchise. We know what he's overcome in his battle with cancer to come back. He's a very popular player right now.
Yeah.
But what do you do? They're young pitching. They have got some pitching coming, but it's going to take some time for that pitching to mature to the point where they can compete with Tampa, the Yankees, Boston, and Toronto. This is a really hard division, as we know, for a young team to make some progress. And I think Baltimore is at least 2 years away from being relevant and competitive for a division title based on how soon their young pitching is going to show up and what they do with Mancini. Do you trade him for prospects right now? I think they probably bring him back, but it's a really tough choice for Mike Elias this winter.
A team being disappointing is difficult on the fans, but a team that has no hope and has had no hope for a long period of time, it makes you wonder what fans think. Like, how do you keep dishing out $50 to go to the ballpark when right. you know there's not much chance of them winning that game, and there's no chance of them winning anything beyond that.
Right.
It's been quite a struggle. Morosi, thank you for wearing the jacket. I know you didn't do it for us. You did it for your TV buddies, but we appreciate it nonetheless.
I felt like it was important to bring the jacket out for this conversation. I you know, Bob, I have so much respect for you and John. I wanted to class it up on my end so I could play in your league. And how about this, to the benefit of our listeners, because I have to run to the TV responsibilities, you don't even have to listen to Morosi's random hockey musings this time around. But trust, I've got plenty of them for next time. My take on being part of the draft coverage was a lot of fun. I'll review all that stuff going forward, but no hockey musings from Morosi today. I'm putting that on vacation for now.
We've had lots of hockey this week. So,
okay. I heard great conversation with Eddie Olchuk. I heard Kevin Weeks recently. I listened to the show. You guys do a great job. I love listening to you guys.
We love you for doing it.
Thanks, guys.
Don't forget, the season is about to start.
Oh, you know? Please.
Good luck to the Buckeyes. We'll see you in November, Bob.
Good luck to the, Michigan, Wolverines. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's been a while since I've had to use that word. Pardon the profanity. JP Morosi, we'll come back and wrap it after these messages. So again, our thanks to John Paul Morosi of Michigan. Don't hold it against him, especially if you're a Buckeye fan. He shows great respect to the team that kicks the snot out of his every fall. I wanted to chat with you briefly about last night's hockey game between Canada and the U.S., the women's game.
Yeah.
And I'm here to confess, I don't follow it as closely as many others do. But I thought Canada had kind of a rebuilding lineup. Mm-hmm. I thought the U.S. was by far the strongest team in this tournament.
Veteran laden.
And the U.S. beats Canada as often as they lose to Canada. Maybe a bit more they beat them,
mm-hmm.
especially of late. Canada wiped them out last night.
Yeah, don't put too much stock in it. And as soon as you see the score, dominant for Canada, it certainly looks like that. But you know how international hockey tournaments go. This is the end of the round robin.
Didn't really matter that much.
It doesn't matter. Is it great for the Canadian program to have a big game like that? Yes. But tell me Wednesday morning next week after the gold medal game. When you look at you're right about Canada have it rebuilding, but the Americans and the quality of their veteran players, it's going to be interesting to see if Canada keep up. The one thing is, for the longest time, the Americans were a faster team. And I'm not talking for 4 or 5 months. I'm talking for 4 or 5 years.
Yes.
They were a much faster team. That certainly didn't appear to be the case in the game that we watched. So that's a positive for Canada. They had to improve their speed to beat the Americans, and it certainly looks like they've done that. I mean, it was, that's where the younger players on the Canadian program, similar to what we saw at the soccer, Bob, this next generation of young female athletes, that playing for Canada, they seem to have upped the skill and up the competitive level at this point.
Any chance Canada and the U.S. don't meet for the gold medal next week? I mean, I know there's always
always a chance. I doubt it. I mean, listen, this truly is one of the great rivalries in sports at any level.
Well, the one thing that I will say is gone are the 16-0 games, at least for the time being. I mean, at least the other countries are far more representative.
Yep. Yeah, you're right. You're right. And women's hockey, and I mean, I remember going back and being involved in that, the World Hockey Congress here in Toronto. And the biggest concern was that there was only two teams. And
yes,
if there was only two teams and the other countries did not contribute to the success of the program, women's hockey was going to be taken out of the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be taken out. And there have been some really great stories from Finland, from Sweden, from Switzerland over the last couple of Olympics, particularly, but world championships that have given a new life to the women's hockey program around the world.
All right, we're going to take next week off as advertised. We'll have best ofs for you if you want to keep tuned in. And well, if not, we can't force you.
What?
A week Monday, we'll be back and with some exciting news to pass along to all. John, I'll miss you.
No, you won't.
Not even a little bit.
I know.
For John Shannon, Bob McCowan, see ya.